Let's carry on a little bit. So now what we're going to do, and this is going to be even more wild, right? Are you ready for something wild? Okay. So this is going to be a sutta that you probably have never heard of before, and this is called the Great Dreams. Yeah, and sometimes I thought, okay, it's nice. Let's do something that I haven't done. I don't think I've done this here before. And so I thought, let's do something different. Maybe I have done it before. Maybe I'm just kind of deluding myself. But anyway, this is quite unusual. The five great dreams of the Bodhisattva, of the Buddha before his awakening, right? So let's have a look at this just as a kind of slightly different approach to the Dhamma. And please, did I lose it? Ah, because I did that one there. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. No worries. So there's so many different angles on the Dhamma, and this is part of the thing that happened to the Buddha before his awakening. He had these great dreams, and they were part of the cause of the awakening of the Buddha. And that's kind of extraordinary, right? So I thought that might be interesting, just for a bit of fun. It is not kind of super deep Dhamma, anything like that, just as a kind of alternative. Just like your kids want fun in the Sunday school, we're going to have Sunday school, yeah? Five great dreams, okay? This is fun for everyone. So there you are. This is it. So let's have a quick look at this sutta. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya 5. This is the numerical discourses of the Buddha, the fifth book, the five, sutta number 196. So it's way out there somewhere. This is how the sutta goes, right? Mendicants, before his awakening, five great dreams appeared to the realized one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha. When he was still not awake, but intent on awakening. Okay, slightly unusual phrasing. Anyway, so here we have the same thing we had before. Remember that it is here saying that this happened to him before the Buddha, very clearly indicated, while he was still a bodhisattva, intent on awakening. It's said very clearly here. So we know that this happened to the Buddha maybe while he was practicing, maybe under the two teachers, sometime during this period, he would have had this kind of five great dreams, maha supina, great dreams. So what are these five great dreams? This great earth was his bed. Himalaya, the king of mountains, was his pillow. His left hand was laid down on the eastern sea. His right hand laid down on the western sea. And both his feet were laid down in the southern ocean. Right? This is a dream that the Buddha-to-be had before his awakening here. That's kind of interesting. What does this mean? So you will notice here that the great earth, right? Basically his head is resting on the Himalaya, which is the north, very north of India. And then the southern ocean, these are the oceans around India. So when we're talking about the great earth, in those days the great earth basically was India. That was the great earth, yeah? They didn't really know about anything outside of India. They just knew about that. So it was a very kind of small kind of area. And anyone who lived from outside of India that they maybe had heard about, they were the barbarians. It's interesting, isn't it? Every culture is like that. Our culture is the center of the world. The people outside, they are the barbarians. Every culture of the world is the same. Ancient India was also just like that. It's kind of fascinating how we always think of ourselves as the most evolved, the highest. We are the best. Everyone else, they are kind of dodgy characters. And so that is the his bed was the whole earth. So you get an idea here that the Buddha is like encompassing everything, right? He's kind of, he has this idea, this future vision of some kind of where he is like encompasses the whole world in a sense with his personality. And interesting, the Himalaya mountains, right? These are known as the king of mountains. Even today, they are the greatest mountains on the earth. These mountains are often called like the center of the world. The Axis Mundi, I think they're sometimes called. They are like the core of what the earth kind of revolves around, these mountains. So when you take these mountains as your pillow, it says something about that you are taking kind of your, it's almost like you become, you are above everything in the world, right? And you kind of become superior to everything. You rise above everything here. Because even these mountains are just your pillow. These which are the core or center of the earth, so to speak. And then your left hand lay down in the eastern ocean, the right hand in the western ocean, and your feet in the southern ocean. It means that the whole world is encompassed by this, by your body. You are kind of larger than everything here. So this is this idea that the Buddha, and we shall see later on, the meaning of this dream is basically that the Buddha becomes awakened. The moment you are awakened, you have a vision of the whole world, understanding of the whole world, and the whole world is encompassed within that vision. So awakening is larger than anything else. So this is kind of interesting. So what is this about? Why does the Buddha have this? What is going on here? What is the purpose of this? Why does the Buddha even say these things? And the purpose seems to be that I assume that this had an effect on the Buddha to be, right? When he had these kind of dreams, maybe that strengthened his idea that he was on the right track, that he was moving towards some kind of future state of really understanding, of comprehending the world properly. If you know a little bit about dreams, one of the interesting things about dreams, it is quite common to have prophetic dreams, to dream about the future. Yeah, it's quite a common thing. Dreams can be very random, they can be about all kinds of stuff, but there are certain dreams that even if you are an arahant, even if you're fully enlightened, because they're not based on delusion, they're based on prophecy or understanding the future, actually they... may be possible even for arahants. Of course, he's not an arahant yet, but he's obviously very pure already at this point. And so maybe this kind of added to his belief and faith that he was on the right track. This may have been a motivating force. Yeah, we're talking about dying and death, and of course these are the important ones, but these dreams may have added a little bit to that motivating force. And I think this says something about the ancient Indian society. They're very different from our societies. If you tell someone that you had a prophetic dream, what would people say to you? They say, you're nuts. They say, what are you talking about, prophetic dreams? There's no such thing. You're just dreaming. Right? So the thing about the ancient Indian society was more open to these kind of things. They believed in rebirth. They believed in karma. They believed in the power of mind in a very different way from what we do now. And because of that, they were probably open to the idea of prophetic dreams. So in that culture, in that setting, a prophetic dream may have been very powerful. Because actually, you think, maybe it is true. In our present day, we wouldn't necessarily think about it. Actually, I've heard of people who've had dreams about the future. They've had kind of very clear dreams about a place they were going to go, a house that looked in a certain way. And suddenly they were really surprised because after traveling somewhere, there was that house that they had seen in that dream. It was like, wow, this is exactly the house I saw in that dream last week. And it's kind of, how is that possible? And it's, you know, a house is often very, if it is a nice house, it is very specific. It is made for that person. It only exists one of those houses in the whole world. So if you see that house in the dream, you know it is the same house. That's kind of awesome. So these things, I think that these things are probably possible. There is quite a lot of evidence, apparently, that these things are possible. So in the right kind of society, these things may actually have a certain power. They may have a certain influence. And so I think for the Buddha to be, these dreams may actually have been a motivating factor in his awakening here. So here he has this dream of encompassing the whole earth, right? And it's like, what's going on here? And then, of course, what's going on is the sense that now I have this broad, the Buddha has this broad vision of existence and of reality here. Let's just read them first. I'll come back to the meaning afterwards. This is the first great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening here. Next, a kind of grass called the crosser grew up from his navel and stood pressing against the cloudy sky. I'll just read them out and we can discuss them in a second. This is the second dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening here. Next, white caterpillars with black heads crawled from his feet and covered his knees. Strange dreams, yeah? This is the third great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening here. Next, four birds of different colors came from the four directions. They fell at his feet, turning pure white. This is the fourth dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening here. Next, he walked back and forth on the top of a huge mountain of filth while remaining unsoiled. This is the fifth great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening here. So let's see what these things mean. Now, as to when before his awakening, the realized one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha was still not awake but intent on awakening, this great earth was his bed. Himalaya, the king of mountain, was his pillow. His left hand was laid down in the eastern sea, the right hand in the western sea, both feet in the southern sea. This was fulfilled when the Buddha awakened to the perfect awakening here. So as I said, that this dream basically meant that he achieved the awakening. He had the all-encompassing wisdom of understanding the world and the nature of reality here. As to when a kind of grass called the crosser grew up from his navel and stood pressing against the cloudy sky. Yeah, so the idea here of the grass growing up from the navel apparently is quite a common idea. It also existed in Brahmanism or Hinduism at the time. And the idea seems to be that you're connecting the earth with a higher realm. Here the sky can be considered either, it can be considered the Devaloka, which the Brahmanical teaching wanted you people to get reborn in the Devaloka with Brahma. Or in Buddhism, it can be considered maybe as Nibbana. Yeah? You grow out and the grass, the crosser, in other words, it is the grass which crosses over samsara, right? It cross goes across and it goes from this shore of ordinary worldly existence to Nibbana on the other side. Yeah, it is the Noble Eightfold Path, the path that is a simile for, right? You're moving from one place to another one here. Pressing against the cloudy sky, going all the way out as far as you can possibly see here. This was fulfilled when, after the Buddha awakened to the Noble Eightfold Path, is what was proclaimed wherever there are gods and humans. It allows you to cross and move beyond, and this has a meaning in that context of ancient India. And of course, the Buddha to be, he would have understood that, because this was part of that tradition and culture at the time. As for the white caterpillars with black heads crawled up from his feet and covered his feet and covered his knees. Yeah, and white caterpillars with black heads. And I saw a picture of these caterpillars because these caterpillars, apparently they exist. There are such caterpillars with black heads and white bodies. Do you have them here in Malaysia? You haven't seen them? Okay, you haven't seen them. You have missed out. And they're very cute caterpillars. I saw them, black heads and white bodies. They're quite nice. Can you imagine what they are? What might they be? Well, imagine the Indians, right? Ancient Indians, they had quite dark skin sometimes. So the head is dark, and then they wear white clothes, yeah? Because they are the Upasakas. So the caterpillars with black heads and white, they are the Upasakas, right? They are the lay followers of the Buddha. Yeah? And then they crawl from the feet up to the knees, right? And I don't know exactly why that is, but the feet are the lowest part of the body, yeah, according to Buddhism. So when you crawl from the feet, it's like you're starting out very low, and then you crawl upwards, yeah, and you become more purified in that movement. Maybe up, I don't know why it stops at the knees, but anyway, it stops at the knees. should go maybe to the head, I'm not sure. So this is the idea here, probably behind this, yeah, the white caterpillars crawling up, all the lay people. So you're all a bit caterpillars. You feel like caterpillars? caterpillars. Maybe you should call yourself the caterpillars, yeah? Sort of brothers and sisters. Call them, hey, caterpillar, how are you today? There's a new idea for you. Sheep, okay, the black heads and white bodies, and sheep, okay. This was fulfilled when many white-clothed lay people went for refuge to him for life. This was the third great dream that appeared to him while he was still not awakened. Caterpillars. As to when the four birds of different colors came from the four quarters, they fell at his feet, turning pure white. Yeah? You can imagine what this is. The four birds are the four castes in India. Yeah, in ancient India they had four castes. They had the Brahmins. They had the Kshatriyas, the kind of the administrative class. Yeah, the warriors. And then you had the Vaisyas, which are the kind of merchant class, and you had the Sudras or the Suddhas, which are like the workers or the even, you know, whatever else. And so what he is saying here is that when you come to the Buddha and you ordain, you lose your status of your caste. Yeah, when you become a monk or a nun, you no longer belong to the caste. You just become a disciple of the Buddha. You lose the colors you had before, and you turn white. And again, this idea of white, yeah, being pure, is a kind of this idea of purity. You're living well. Now you are measured by your purity and not by your birth. And this is what you find in the suttas all the time, the idea that we are measured by our purity, we're measured by our virtue. Virtue is what actually gives the sense of whether someone is a good person or not where they were born. So this is one of the beautiful things about the Sangha, is that you should lose all that kind of status is left behind when you enter the Sangha, and you don't actually have those kind of status symbols anymore. And this is a very important thing to remember, because in the modern world, some of the idea of caste is kind of returning to the Sangha again. And there are places where caste actually is said to be significant and important and even used within the Sangha. You cannot enter the Sangha unless you belong to a certain caste. And that is kind of really bad idea. And it really goes completely against how the Buddha taught these things. But it's also important to remember that the Buddha didn't really try to abolish the caste in India. He wasn't a social reformer. It's just that within the Sangha itself, the castes were abandoned, and what measured you as a person was actually whether you were living well or not. The people who are called superior people in the suttas are the people who are the Aryas, the noble ones, the stream enterers. And it's kind of one of the nice ironies is that even though they are called superior, of course, if you are a noble one, you don't feel superior. Yeah, you have given up all the conceit. You have given up the idea of measuring yourself against other people. So you are superior precisely because you have given up superiority. Yeah, that's kind of the weird thing about these things. And this is part of this kind of movement towards that. Giving up of the caste. This was fulfilled when members of the four castes, the aristocrats, the Brahmins, the merchants, and the workers, went forth from lay life to homelessness in the teaching and training proclaimed by the realized one and realized supreme freedom. Okay, and realized supreme freedom. So also the realization is also part of that. Aristocrats is the word that Siddhartha used for Kattiyas or Kshatriyas. So I guess that is an acceptable translation. I wonder. Anyway, let's go on. This was the fourth dream that appeared to him while he was still not awakened. As to when he walked back and forth on top of a huge mountain of filth while remaining unsoiled. Yeah, what do you think this might be? Walking back and forth on a huge mountain of filth while remaining unsoiled. Well, this could mean a number of different things. Yeah, one of the things that... what was that? Defilements. Yeah? So, huge amount of defilements. Okay, yeah? Yes, I think that's basically what it comes down to. Yeah, elsewhere in the suttas, the Buddha talks about like the lotuses who grow in the pond. Yeah, and sometimes the lotus grows out of the pond, no longer soiled by the water. You stand above the earth. And the Buddha, even though the Buddha is part of the world, he still belongs in the world, he's also above the world, he's no longer touched by the world. The defilements, all the things of the world are kind of left behind. This is one way of looking at this. But actually the meaning here is slightly different. And here you go for the meaning. This was fulfilled when the realized one received robes, arms, food, lodgings, and medicines and supplies for the sick. And he used them untied, uninfatuated, unattached, seeing the drawbacks and understanding the escape. Yeah, so the last thing that you have as a monk or a nun is you have the four requisites, yeah, the alms food, the lodgings, and the medicines. These are the things that you have, robes. Of course, it is very easy to become attached to these things. You want to have a nice kuti, just right. You want to have the nice robes. Yeah, it has to be the right kind of material, not some dodgy material, the real deal. You want to have a bowl with the right kind of bowl stand. You will be surprised in many places around the world, there is fashion in bowl stands. There is fashion in monks' requisites. And you have to have the latest kind of requisite. Is that still happening in Thailand, Venerable? If people are fashionable, fashion requisites? Have you seen this happening? The nuns in Thailand are too pure to get into this kind of thing. So well done. I'm very happy about that. But I have seen these things happening, and there has to be the right kind of thing, otherwise it's not. So it's very easy to get into this kind of silliness, even as a monastic. The nuns are pure. The nuns are very pure. very embarrassing to be a monk. You have. So it's true though. So it's actually very easy to get it. You know, it can happen very easily because you're still into these kind of things. But if you are a good monastic, you don't really bother about such things because you realize it's just a residue of attachment. So the Buddha calls it filth, right? Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So whenever you give a requisite to a monk, if the monk or nun thinks of it as filth, please give me that filth, then. You're doing something positive, right? So don't take it personally if they call it filth. You know, even the Buddha called it filth. Here is some filthy food for you. Yeah, when you offer the breakfast in the morning, please accept this filth. You can try that tomorrow morning if you're around and see what happens. It's fascinating. What is so interesting about when you become an arahant is you have the ability to see things in exactly the way you want to see things, depending on the circumstances. So on the one hand, if you think there is a danger of attachment, you can see it as filth. Yeah, actually, real happiness doesn't come from this. This is a lower kind of happiness. I'm not really interested in that. That's one side of the arahant kind of idea. On the other hand, if you are a good meditator, you tend to enjoy the things of the world much more because you can really taste that food. Because you don't have any craving, because your mind is pure, you can fully appreciate the flavor of the food. And it says in the suttas, if someone comes out of a jhana state and you get an ordinary meal of really plain food, yeah, you don't get that plain food here in BGF. Here you only get the best food. I get the super duper food every day. It's very kind of you. I appreciate that, but maybe you should, no. but even if you get really, really plain food, it sounds like the king's meal. That's what it tastes like because your mind is so pure. Right? Very often when we eat, have you noticed when you eat, you are eating. You're eating one spoon, and while you're eating, that's when you're already looking for the next one. What are you going to have next? Craving is there while you're eating. You're always looking for something more. You're never really staying what you're doing. It's true, isn't it? It's life. But because the arahant doesn't have that, they're fully able to enjoy what's happening right now. So the robes they have are like the best cloth in the world. The dodgy food they get, yeah, is the best food in the world. And that's how they also see it. So being an arahant is like having this ability to shift your perception all the time, depending on the situation, to really appreciate it, but also to see it as something low at the same time, or whatever. This is kind of the arahant mind. It's a very flexible mind that can change perception very fast, because of that being able to see different sides of things. Just to give you a more balanced view of this, it is not just filth, it is actually more to it than that. But it is filth when you are attached to it. That is the problem. The attachment is the problem, not the thing in itself. This was the fifth great dream that appeared to him while he was still not awakened. Before his awakening, these five great dreams appeared to the realized one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha, while he was still not awake, but intent on awakening. So these were the things, and they obviously gave him a little bit of something that made it even more possible, motivated to actually practice the path all the way. So anyway, just a bit of fun for you, just to do something a little bit different. Now let us do a little bit of meditation together again. If you have any questions or comments again, please, now is a good time to ask. Venerable, at the front, at the very front here, Bobby, the Venerable, Punsiri, Punsirivara. Yeah.
I listened to Ajahn Sambat Thai monk.
Uh-huh.
He was teaching the Tipitaka. He talked about the dream. He said that Arahant has no dream.
I don't know. Maybe that's true. I'm not sure. But I think the problem with dream is that dream is usually considered to be delusion. And Arahant cannot have delusion, right? And that's why they say Arahant has no dreams, because a dream is delusion. But if there may be some dreams that are not delusion, and I think a prophetic dream may be one of the exceptions to delusion, and because it is a prophetic dream, maybe an Arahant can have prophetic dream. Maybe not. Probably not. But I'm just wondering if it might be possible in certain situations. The reason he says that is probably from the commentary. It's probably not. It doesn't say anywhere in the suttas that Arahant cannot have dream. So it is probably some commentarial tradition, and so it may not be 100% reliable. But maybe it's true. Maybe it is true. Yeah. I'm not sure what the answer. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm still had dreams sometimes. So I'm not Arahant.
Are you Arahant? Not Arahant. Not Arahant. Okay. So we haven't proven anything by the, you have
sometimes
dreams. Sometimes
okay. I have dreams, but vain, not too often.
When you become Arahant, visit us now, and we'll know. We'll find out.
I want to ask this question.
Yeah.
Arahant is achieved in this lifetime or after death?
Say again? Yeah?
Oh.
Yeah.
I want to know, Arahantship is achieved in this present lifetime or after death?
Arahant is achieved in this life.
This life?
Yeah, so there's no excuse.
Because in those following the Mahayana tradition, Arahant is someone who is not in this realm,
Okay, I think maybe they have different kinds of Arahants.
Oh, I see.
But one of the things about the Buddhist teaching, which I think is very important about Buddhism, is that everything can be achieved in this life. This is what makes Buddhism different from almost all other religions, because other religions you have to wait till after you die to find out whether there is a God or not. Is there a God? Don't know. If there isn't after you die, tough luck. You made a bad choice, right? And there is no God there. But in Buddhism, the whole point is that we can know in this life. That is what is so beautiful about these teachings. Okay, yes, please.
I have one question.
Yeah.
Looking at this sutta, I would never guess what the dream actually meant. Not a single one of them.
Sorry?
I look at this sutta, I would never guess what the dream actually meant.
Right.
Even for a single one of them.
Yeah.
It's so difficult.
Yeah.
But in Malaysia, it's very easy. When you have a dream, you consult a book, will tell you what number to buy.
Okay, all right. Okay, so what shall we... So that's the... okay. Okay, not sure what the conclusion to draw from that one. But anyway, we'll leave it, let it be, let it rest. Excellent. Anyone else, please? Yeah, please. Okay.
Bhante, one more question from my kids.
Okay.
They asked me what is Nibbana, because after going to Sunday school and they've been drilling into them, Nibbana. When they asked the teacher said that's the ultimate state. What is the ultimate state? It's the ultimate state. So they came home and they asked me, so I said, after listening to your videos on YouTube, right, and Ajahn Brahm, we are all made up of energy, right? So I told them Nibbana is a state whereby the energy calms down. And then Ajahn Brahm did say in one of his videos that we are made up of atoms, nucleus and all, and we are all vibrating due to the energy.
Yeah.
because kids nowadays, they are very, they need something to be tangible and it needs to be proven, especially scientifically for my kids lah. So I based it on that. So I want to know, is that correct? The way
Yeah, I think it is not a bad answer. Yeah, because things calm down, the vibrations stop. I mean, it's kind of the you know, there's obviously a lot of truth to that. Calm, Nibbana is the highest kind of peace. But I would say, if a kid asks you what Nibbana is, I would say it's the highest happiness, because this is what everyone wants. Yeah, everyone wants to be happy. So it's the highest kind of happiness you can have as a human being. That's Nibbana. That kind of takes away some of the problem here.
Because for my kids, the definition of highest happiness differs from one another due to perceptions. They have learned this word, perceptions.
It depends on the perception.
Yeah, of an individual. So they told me, Mommy, your Nibbana and my Nibbana is two different things.
Well, you have to tell them, remember that the spiritual path develops you and it changes you as a person. So it is different from different people as long as you are undeveloped in mind, undeveloped in meditation practice. But when you practice the meditation all the way and you follow the path, then actually that changes. And that perception of Nibbana is the same for everyone, precisely because you go through a process of development. So you don't know what Nibbana is if you haven't developed the mind. That's why the perception is different for everyone. So you have to go through the process first of all. So you have to tell them there's a path to get there. Only when you come to the end of the path do you understand this kind of happiness. You cannot understand it with the present mind. So there is a movement towards that. But what you can know, and this is kind of the idea, you can know that when the mind is peaceful, when you have a good day and everyone is kind and everyone is pleasing, then you feel more happy. And when the mind is really agitated and everyone is nasty and difficult, then it's more difficult. And so when Nibbana means things are calming down, things are more happy, yeah? That is the movement towards Nibbana when things are calm and peaceful. That is a little bit of Nibbana. It gives you a foretaste for the real Nibbana, which is the absolute calm, the absolute stillness, and therefore also the highest happiness. So ask them, okay, when do you feel really happy? Yeah, and they will give you some idea of, it can be, how old are your kids?
12 and 13.
12 and 13, okay, yeah. Still very young, and it can be hard to kind of get their heads around some of these things, right?
Yeah.
So you just have to tell them that there is a happiness which is the same for everyone, and that is the high happinesses of Nibbana, but it only appears when you practice the path fully. You can practice the path a little bit now by being kind, and you have a little bit of idea what Nibbana is, but it goes much further than that.
There's another thing, Ajahn. You said not to send them to Sunday school, right? I can't, Ajahn, because in school, right, there are Christian kids. When my kid told them that they are Buddhist, then they said, oh, Buddha is a devil. How can you follow that? So then they come back and tell me, Mommy, when I say that I'm a Buddhist, this is what I'm called. The Christians have a way of finding loopholes, and they start the kids young, Bhante. That is why I notice a lot drop out walking this path, even at a very young age. And we as parents, we are going through a lot of struggle. Because, how to say, everything is not tangible, Bhante. You know, these 2 days, right? A lot of things they cannot see, because everything is so fast now.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, it's a challenge for parents.
Is it a Christian school that they go to? Or?
No, it's a government school.
Government school, all right. Okay. Well, I mean, you know, people are just stupid, you know. I mean, saying these kind of things is just kind of stupid. And I think those kids who are Christian now and say this kind of thing, they may end up as Buddhists down the track, because they realized that they were saying stupid things when they were younger. And I think the same thing with your kids. Instead of sending them to Sunday school, just tell them that those kids don't know what they're talking about. They're just parroting what the parents have told them. They have no idea what's going on. Yeah, and just teach them instead of sending them to Buddhist school, just teach them some common sense about these kind of things. Obviously, it's just nonsense when people say that these kids don't know what they're talking about. You know, they're just children. And so tell your kids to, okay, you know, just ignore stupid people because stupid people are not worth listening to. That's what you should tell them probably, rather than send them to Sunday school. That's my idea anyway. Yes, please.
John, I think, sister, you don't need to worry about sending them to Sunday school because I think we have got this group of facilitators. Sister Mei Liu, I think you've heard of her. Sister Mian, right? The Sunday school facilitators, I think inclusive of those from BGF, have attended a mindfulness session for teaching the children from the various ages, which we are going to introduce starting this year. So we are making a shift from going towards, you know, Jataka stories and things like that, towards teaching the children mindfulness rather than going through that. So you don't have to worry about sending your children to Sunday school. We are making a shift towards all those things.
Okay, excellent. So there's going to be like a Sunday school here, is that what you're saying? Yeah. But mindfulness Sunday school, not kind of Jataka Sunday school. Huh? Yeah. Okay. And that's really cool. So there you are. There you have the new options for the future. They're going to learn something real, not some dodgy stuff. That's marvelous. Let's stop there because it's getting already quarter past four. Let's have half an hour break and then we come down for the last session on the Q&A at quarter to five.